a real factorization engine. And it has, once you get into the nuts and bolts, it's not a general purpose quantum computer, which would actually be harder to make. There's a lot of structure in the Shor factorization algorithm that makes it a little bit easier to build such a machine. So, I should go back one, because I'd like to feature my student, Thomas Schopek, who will be starting this fall at McGill University, who's mostly responsible for most of the things that I'm describing. And so I think you'll be very happy to have him as a colleague. In thinking seriously about the architecture, one of the big questions that's going to come up is the internal communications. And, you know, there are different options. For example, in the ion trap machines, they actually move the ions around. That's one way of communicating. And, you know, nearest neighbor communications is very easy, but long distance communication, like this particular CNOT gate, is not so easy. So how do we do communication over longer distances? And that's going to be very important. And you'll see it come out in the second half of the talk. The first thing I'd like to do is emphasize that we sometimes don't think correctly about the error threshold. And we think about 99.99% fidelity and then 5/9 fidelity. Says, how are we ever going to do that experimentally? That sounds very, very hard. But maybe it's not quite as bad as it sounds. And the reason is that the errors that we make, the ones that, in my opinion, one should be most concerned about, are the gate operation errors. And maybe you're putting on a pi pulse, and instead of a pi pulse, instead of 9 degrees, it's 90.1 degrees or 90.5 degrees. So you could be putting on a pulse, and let's say you were waiting for it to precess around, and it overshoots by a certain small angle. Now, it's very important to ask, well, what is the error? How much error can we tolerate in the overshoot of a qubit on the block sphere? Well, if we talk about the error, people talk about the error, it's the projection of this qubit onto where it should have been, which is the x-axis. It overshot. And that error is sine squared of phi over 2, and so sine squared of phi over 2 is actually this small little error. Okay, but if you ask, well, what about the gate operation? How accurate did that have to be? Well, that error was this angle. So you could ask, suppose you have an error of a half a degree, which would be 1/100th of a radian. Okay, and that works out to be only an error of 2. You know, it's around a little over 10^-5 error in the logical qubit. And so if you go to an experimentalist and say you need analog fidelity of 99.999%, he says, I have no idea how to do that. But if you tell the experimentalist you need a phase accuracy of better than half a degree, then maybe he has a chance of doing that. So I think it's very important to keep that in mind. Now, I think this is somewhat obvious, but somehow it has people have lost sight of this. And so my assertion is that maybe somewhere in the area of a fraction of a degree phase error might be good enough. And just to mention, if you buy standard waveform generators any time in the last 30 or 40 years, you could get phase errors like this quite reliably. So it's not that hard. Just this one thing is not that hard to get. Now, there have been recently some important studies, just in the past year or so, some important studies on the accuracy or the threshold in certain situations that would be practical situations for laying out quantum computing architecture. So one of the situations that people have analyzed is one-dimensional cases. And you'll see in a minute why the 1D cases are often analyzed. But if you have a 1D array of qubits, but the communication, somehow you have communication at a distance and it's perfect, then you get, even in 1D, you get reasonable fault-tolerant error thresholds. However, if you restrict the 1D communication to be nearest neighbor, which is the easiest thing to implement, then there's a penalty, of course. And so this was actually put out by my student Thomas Skopek about a year ago. And the important thing to note, though, is that the penalty is not overwhelming. And it looks bad because it's 100 in the error threshold, but in terms of the phase angle accuracy, it's only about a factor of 12 or 13 below the case of perfect communication, perfect and unlimited communication. So this gives us an idea, and I think gave people the idea, that maybe these this nearest neighbor communication, which is very easy to implement, particularly in semiconductor architectures, that maybe it's acceptable. Well, a very important development emerged in May of a few months ago in May from DiVincenzo and Terhal, and they analyzed the same thing instead of in one dimension, in two dimension, and both cases are very important in laying out a practical quantum information processor. And what they found is that the penalty was extremely small in two dimensions. In other words, the penalty associated with the restriction to nearest neighbor communication was hardly any penalty at all. It's very close to, it's within a factor of two of the threshold that you would get from free and unlimited communication over long distances. And so this gives us an idea that maybe we can look at nearest neighbor architectures and maybe we can make them rather practical. And so here I'm giving the error threshold, the way I like to give it, is in terms of phase angle accuracy. And we're in a reasonable range. We're at a fraction of a degree. Now, to put that into context, a half a degree corresponds to 30 picosecond accuracy in a 10 nanosecond gating pulse. And so this is something that definitely technology is capable of doing. Now, this is I threw this table in. I hate tables because one shouldn't use tables, one should use pictures. But nonetheless, this is a table of the T2s that you find in nature. We heard about this earlier at the meeting, is that electrons trapped in silicon have been shown to have extremely long T2s and can probably be even longer than 60 milliseconds. There are other great examples we heard at this meeting, the Envy Center in Diamond, 2 to 100 microseconds. We can forget about the two. Many groups are reporting 100 microseconds and more now. The donor, the nitrogen donor in Diamond, we ask what's the difference between these two cases, is that here you have a vacancy adjacent to the nitrogen, and this is like an ordinary donor. The trouble with the ordinary donor, it's great. It has tremendously long lifetimes for the spin, even at room temperature, but we don't have an optical handle on it. It doesn't respond to light. But still, it's very thought-provoking that these things run at room temperature, and maybe we'll have these types of quantum information processors just in our shirt pocket because it could just be running at ambient temperatures. Here's another case that was investigated. The nitrogen inside carbon 60. Again, at 300 degrees in a liquid solution, no less. And still 120 microsecond T2 time. Very impressive. Here's something that's relevant in silicon technology where silicon dioxide plays a role. Well, it's not that great, but it's sort of okay. I mean, it's like if you have to, maybe you could do something with this. 20 microsecond lifetime T2 at room temperature. So this sort of gives you an idea of what's out there. And I think that we can look forward possibly to some of the cases, at least, operating at room temperature. This is sort of a picture of what you can do with trapped electrons. The idea is to trap them with gates. And there's a lot you can do. You have a very nice analogy between the germanium silicon system and the aluminum gallium arsenide system, and you can make 2D electron gases and electrostatically trap electrons and manipulate their spin and so forth. This is an example, sort of a primitive example, an early example, of trapping a little potential well here, which you can adjust so that you can get out all the electrons except one electron, and just being held there by electrostatic forces. And you can also, even it's been reported, especially by the Delft group, that you can measure the spin. Here's an example of some data where you have this little dot, and you're basically using an adjacent transistor to measure the electric charge. Transistors are very good electrometers. They measure electric charge. And you can sort of, by adjusting the potentials on the gates, you push out the electrons one by one until at the end you just have one last electron. And this is sort of the transistor signal from the charge of one electron. And measuring charge is the key to measuring spin, because we have mechanisms for converting spin to electric charge. So we can envision this the electrons trapped in semiconductors as being possible qubits. Well, they're qubits, but are they good enough for a full practical huge array? Let's see. Well, I mentioned that the worst possible case for communication is a 1D array. That's about as bad as you can get. Now, what pushes us toward the 1D? Well, it has to do with the wiring. Suppose we have a bunch of qubits, and this is a cross-section, so they're going across this way. And they're going out of the page. You might have a long array of them. We've just taken the cross-section here. Notice that there's only limited room for wiring. There's limited numbers of levels of metal. And according to the number of levels of metal, you can only address a finite number. In fact, in today's technology, we have about 10 levels of metal, and we could only, under those circumstances, address 20 of them across in that way. And so we tend to be pushed toward one-dimensional designs by this requirement for being able to bring the wires in. By the way, this is one of the most difficult things in transistor technology to change. It's almost like a law of nature that you cannot have all that many levels of metal, because your yield goes down. If you make too many levels of metal, I mean, this takes about 100 steps to make 10 levels of metal, and you take 99% yield, raise it to the 100th power, and before you know it, you don't have much yield left. And so that's why this is sort of like a constant nature. And that tends to force one to 1D geometries, but they can be quite varied. For example, they can be serpentine, or they can be intersecting like this. And this stripe would then be 20 qubits wide. And now, we will eventually be able to overcome this once we get to the point where the analog control circuitry, the classical control circuitry, will eventually become more dense than the qubits, and we'll be able to squeeze all the classical control circuitry above the qubits, because there will be more miniaturization on the classical side than on the quantum side. But until then, we'll be looking at some of these maybe not fully two-dimensional geometries. So I'm going to have some fun here. I'll show you a little exercise that we did with the HRO laboratories in Malibu, just seeing what it would take to implement the unitary operator on a qubit with full error correction. And so we took, as our logical qubit, we took this array. It was a 5 by 11 array, and it had ancillas and all sorts of things. And each of these horizontal lines represents a qubit. And then because it's too hard to see, we color-coded it. So controlled knot is this red thing, and so forth. So you have all the different quantum operations are color-coded. And it gives you an idea of what does it take to go through a full error correction cycle. And so this will give you a little bit of an impression. So you can see, well, you start the error correction cycle here, and you go, and you have all these things. And let's see, the yellows are just swaps of various types. And so you have a lot of yellows here. But look, it just goes on and on. You have to look very closely with a magnifying glass and maybe a high-resolution screen and just follow it. And it just continues. It's a long sequence of operations just to do one error correction. And you say, oh, it goes off the page, so we go to the next one. Oh, and it just continues, you see. And it, now all these little operations are needed. And you say, well, then it continues again to another page. Okay, and it's still going on. And yet another page, and finally we get to the end, and we've completed it. And there's certain operations you do at the end to complete the error correction. This is just the sum of all the operations you have to do. This 1,500 hadamards and 144 sigma x's and that many swaps, the square root of swaps. So it's a lot of operations just to apply the unity operator. Okay, so this gives you an idea of what you have to do. But I challenge you, if you go into a classical computer, it'll be just as complicated. You know, you just follow the logic path like that. So we just have to get used to this way of doing things. So this was laid out in an 11 by 5 array. So let me talk about the fault tolerance. with nearest neighbors. Obviously, the communications is limited. Can you even do fault tolerance at all with nearest neighbor interactions? And I showed you this before. I'll be showing it to you one more time. And these are the fault tolerance thresholds. They're quite reasonable. And yes, even with nearest neighbors, and even with 2D nearest neighbors, we had very good fault tolerance results. So let me show you how the fault tolerance might work. So the physical layout, again, first I'll just do the 1D array, which is sort of like the worst case. And so you can imagine then starting with this the famous 7-qubit code, and I'm writing out the logical qubits. They look kind of big. And what you have to visualize then is that every time you see one logical qubit, it is represented by this whole thing. Okay, and each one of these is represented by this whole thing. And I think L in this case means the levels of recursion or the levels of concatenation. So I believe this would count as 5 levels of concatenation. And so you can see you're going to end up with an extremely long logical qubit in the concatenated situation. In fact, it's like this. You have your 7 qubits, and then each one of those is represented by a whole bunch with a bunch of ancillas, and each one of those is represented by a whole bunch with a bunch of ancillas. And so you can imagine that you could end up, even in one dimension, with a very, very long qubits. Now, how do you do fault tolerance? Well, you bring in the data qubits, you make errors, you bring in cold ancilla qubits, and you throw away the hot ancillas. And in order to make the fault tolerance work, every time you do anything, then you've also got to include all the fault tolerance steps and all the levels of concatenation. Every little step that you do has to be fully error-corrected and possibly in many levels of concatenation and so forth. So it gets to be very tricky. And you end up with a lot of operations. And because of the large number of operations, that's what ends up causing problems with the error threshold. In fact, the error threshold is sort of related to the number of operations according to this formula. This is a well-known formula. And this is how much you can suppress the errors by operating significantly below the error threshold. So keep in mind, we talk about an error threshold. You don't even have any hope at all of doing well unless you're maybe a factor of 10 below that error threshold. And so it's quite demanding. So what about these circuits? Let's talk about swap. What does it take to implement fault-tolerant swap in one dimension with nearest neighbor communication only? So this is our... this is not exactly swap, this is controlled not. But just to notice that if you had free communication, it's not a problem. You interact 2 qubits, these are 2 logical qubits, you interact at a distance. This one is quite far from that one, you interact with it, and so forth. And if you had free and easy communication, that would be the case. But if you don't have free communication, you can only go nearest neighbor. You've got to take that into account in the fault tolerance, but it turns out there's a way to do that. And you end up with these funny trees that look like this, where these two interact, and those two interact, and it's more swaps, and finally you have some controlled knots, and then more swaps. So what has happened? Instead of requiring 7 gate operations with free communication, with nearest neighbor communication, it's a lot more than 7. And this is what reduces the error threshold and makes it tougher to achieve. And so you can just see how big it gets. This is just the first level of concatenation and the second level of concatenation. It gets really big. You can barely fit within the resolution of the computer screen to see the individual operations in there. And so this would require just 2 levels of recursion or concatenation would require 2,400 operations. So that costs you in terms of error threshold. Let me walk through the error-correcting circuit here. There are a great many steps. In each of these steps, you have to visualize how to do it with nearest neighbor operations only. So this is an example of going through the error-correction steps, but only with nearest neighbors. None of this action at a distance stuff. And so let's just go through the steps. So you have a little piece of the circuit. So here's a little piece of the circuit. This is preparing logical zeros. Okay, and you have to do that in a fault-tolerant manner. But you can do it with nearest neighbors, but it costs you. You have to do a type of measurement. And the kind of measurement that I prefer is to use the CNOT gates in classical mode as a type of measuring device, and then you get the benefit of whatever accuracy you have built into the CNOT gates. So they can always be used classically as kind of measuring devices. And then you have to decode the error, and they have the other parts in there. You see each of these is quite big, and then you have to repeat it and rotate the phase errors into bit flips and decode the errors and so forth. So that's everything that it takes to do the full error correction circuit. And that's what gave rise to this graph that gave you a certain penalty for the nearest neighbor communication, which is a severe restriction. And the penalty was a factor of 100 in the error threshold, but a factor of 10 in the gate accuracy. Fortunately, if you do the 2D case, you can do a lot better. And this recent paper in May by DiVincenzo and Terhal, I think this is very encouraging to those people who actually want to make a sure factorization engine, because the penalty, nearest neighbor penalty, was much less in their case than in the pure one-dimensional case. So that's very encouraging. Now, then the problem is, how do you provide internal communications? And so let me describe what the issue is here. And I'm going to be showing this view graph a couple of times. This gives you an example of what are your architectural alternatives. And just like in classical computing, you have an alternative between using a parallel architecture and doing the algorithm very quickly, or using more of a serial architecture but doing it very slowly. And let me dwell on this because it's a little bit important. Let's take this example. This was a paper came out of Australia about 2 years ago that said that you could do with 1D nearest neighbor communication, you could do the Shor factorization algorithm. But notice the problem associated with that. You don't have to use very many qubits. These are logical qubits, so of course the real number of qubits is vastly larger, but still manageable. But the penalty you pay, because you're on a one-dimensional chain, is you have to go back and forth in a fault-tolerant way so many times that there's just a huge number of steps involved. And so even though they gave a nice proof that you could do it all just with a one-dimensional chain and nearest neighbor interactions, it was somewhat flawed. In fact, let me see if I can write this down. We went through this, and this ended up that the factorization would have taken 92 years to factorize 1,000 bit numbers. So that's really not very acceptable. Yes, this is getting a little weak. There's another one. So I'll use the highlighter as a pointer. Okay, so that sort of tells you that you really don't want to use the minimum number of qubits and then take forever to do the factorization. That's not very good. And so each of these architectural proposals going up represents having maybe more qubits, but doing the computation faster. In other words, introducing parallelism. Here's one that is fairly reasonable. You increase the qubits so that... So you increase the qubits, so there are more qubits, and now you can do the calculation faster, and you can do it in L log L time. Now, the best in all these is the proposal by Cleve and Watrous, and I was very interested that Cleve was one of our speakers earlier this week, where you use a very large number of qubits, but then you can tremendously speed it up. And by the way, let me just say what depth is if you don't speak that language. Depth is just how long time. How long the whole thing takes, how many successive clock cycles it would take. So this is very good. If you use a huge number of qubits, you can do the whole computation in logarithmic time. But keep in mind, this is logarithmic time. Then it has to be multiplied by all those levels of fault tolerance and concatenation. So even something in log L time will still take a very long time. Not a very long time, but it certainly it wouldn't be... instantaneous by any means. It's burdened by all those fault-tolerant operations, so it'll be slowed down a little. So what is the critical step in the Shor algorithm? So I'm I'm going to go through it quickly because I'm not that big an expert. But the most difficult step is the modular exponentiation. The part that makes it difficult is that you have to, in exponentiating, you have to multiply things together. So there's a lot of quantum multiplication operations. And the problem with multiplication is that it's quite difficult. And it's time consuming. You'll see where the difficulty lies. If you want to do multiplication quickly, obviously there's a big advantage, and this happens throughout computer science. Instead of doing things sequentially, you try to do them in logarithmic trees, so they go a lot faster. And this is true for the fast Fourier transform, for many other things. And so, for example, if you were multiplying two numbers together, you would multiply them in sort of pairwise here, then the result of those two pairs, you then multiply those. And this is much better than just doing one multiplication after another, because that would take forever, because you'd have to go through each one, one by one. And so the essence of trying to do things quickly, and I mentioned that if we don't do things quickly, we'll end up with algorithms that take 92 years to factorize a number. So we have to do things quickly. So the main trick is to use these logarithmic trees. And that's the trick that everybody has to use. Now, so then comes the question, how do you design this quantum multiplier? And it's pretty obvious. You basically take the products and then add up all the products. It's sort of the way you learn to do multiplication in elementary school. So, and this kind of looks like the way it did in elementary school. You have two numbers. This is your least significant digit. This is your more significant digit. You multiply them together, and then below the line, you have the first product, and shift it over by one unit, you have the second product, and then shift it over by two units, you have the third product, and you have to add up all these columns. And you have to add, when you add up all the columns, you end up doing the multiplication operation. It ends up having a structure a little bit like this, but I like this picture better because it looks like what we learned in elementary school. Now, the problem is that you've got to do everything in logarithmic trees or it'll take too long, including the addition. So how do you do that? So let me try to indicate what you're trying to do. You have a bunch of numbers. So this is the modular exponentiation in Shor's algorithm. You have to multiply stuff. So you have a bunch of numbers and or a bunch of qubits. You want to multiply them by these qubits. Okay. And so the first step you do is you kind of have to distribute these values all the way down along a vertical column. And then you have to distribute the horizontal ones across the horizontal column. Okay, so now you've loaded the values into the matrix, and then you have to multiply them, and you end up with filling the matrix this way. So you multiply them together, and then you have to add them. And the addition can be very slow. If you add one number after another, then that'll take very long. That'll take L time. In other words, it'll be proportional to the number of digits. And you don't want that. You want it to be proportional to the logarithm of the number of digits in the number you're trying to factorize. So the trick is to do it logarithmically, which means first you do all these little squares and add those together. And so that can be represented like this. And then you go to the next step of the logarithmic hierarchy. You do the bigger squares and add those together and get a result. And then you do the biggest square and you add those together. So in this way, you create a logarithmic sequence of operation. You have as much parallelism as possible. And you've reduced the latency of doing this multiplication or modular exponentiation operation. A lot of stuff can be carried over from classical computer science. So one of the things is, what about the carry bits? So even in quantum multiplication, there are carry bits. And they have a way of doing the carry bits. This is a classical procedure. It's a well-known procedure. Again, you can do it in log L steps. You sort of anticipate and you carry the carry bits forward and make things work in logarithmic time. And so the question is, can we really have a two-dimensional sea of qubits? And I think so, but it does require that the qubits should be large enough that you could, within that space, put really sub-miniaturized classical control circuitry to control them. We have examples of that. This is the very beautiful work from last summer by Marcus et al. At Harvard, where they had two qubits, and they did some lovely two-qubit operations. in doing that. Now, if in laying it out as an architecture, though, what we found, it's kind of handy for the qubit to be surrounded by communications qubits. So the yellow ones are just for communications, and the gray one is the real qubit. And what I'm going to try to address is, can we do this all with nearest neighbor operations? So what's going on here? Well, one of the biggest problems is the addition. Now, we could add them up in sequence. That's not smart. So what we have to do is we have to do the operations. We have to do them in a logarithmic tree. So first we do these. Then we do these. And then these. And then finally we add the top sum to the bottom sum. And that's the smartest way of doing it. The problem is that there are going to be some long-distance communication steps in here. And so the real question is, can we do the long-distance communication also in logarithmic time? And that would be a great advantage, and then you wouldn't be slowed down. Well, what's the wrong way to do it? Well, doing nearest neighbor exchange, let's say you have, this is the control qubit, and this is the target qubit, this is not a smart way to do it. Because you would go to the nearest neighbor, and then to the next nearest, and the next. Obviously, it's going to take a whole sequence of operations, and it's not going to be logarithmically fast, which is what we want. So this is the example of just the wrong way of doing it, as just a sequence of simple swaps. So nearest neighbor exchange is too slow, too much latency, and the speed of propagation would be the speed of interaction of the adjacent spins, which would be a magnon propagation speed. It's similar to a sound speed. It's certainly not the speed of light. It wouldn't be fast enough. So we need something else. And one is inspired a little bit by the ideas of quantum repeaters, where you, in a quantum repeater, you have to do a Bell state measurement, and you have to send the result of the Bell state measurement to the final receiver. So Alice with a bunch of repeaters in between, and Bob has to do some operations, has to collect all the classical information, and he can communicate it that way. And there's something very similar that's called entanglement swapping, where you can indeed do things logarithmically in logarithmic speed. And here's the trick. First, you have all these qubits lined up. And first, you entangle them pairwise. All this can be done in parallel. So you entangle all these qubits. Okay. Then you take the other nearest neighbors. You see these are the two nearest neighbors. And then here, these are sort of the odd nearest neighbors. And interact those with C naught and use this as a kind of a classical measuring device, and distinguish Bell states, and then you can convert the spin to charge, and then you have the classical information stored on a capacitor, for example, and you send it along the bus, and at the end you have to do just a classical operation, multiply a bunch of minus ones together, and figure out what operations you need at the far end to make the entanglement swapping work. So keep in mind that entanglement swapping is not the same as just nearest neighbor exchange. It's more sophisticated, and it's something that can be done very quickly as you'll see, in a logarithmic number of steps. As far as measuring the electron is concerned, we have good ways of measuring the electron. I don't want to dwell on it, but there are many examples now in the literature of measuring single charges quickly. So how would one do the addition? You have a column in this matrix. You're trying to do the multiplication, and then you have to add up all the elements of the column. And so what you would do is you'd add them up, and you do the entanglement swapping just in a block. This would be this particular operation, which is sort of like four nearest neighbors away. You'd have a block of them like this, and you would do the same thing. You entangle, distinguish the Bell states, and do spin-to-charge conversion, and collect the information. This would be the control qubit, and this would be the final qubit that is getting controlled. Okay, and so the key thing is that you end up with a binary distribution tree, so that the next step would be this one, is you do the same long-distance communication entanglement swap, but now you're doing it over a longer distance. The beauty of this is that it all happens in one or two clock cycles. It's essentially going at the reasonably close to the speed of light, and this is very important to reduce latency. And so the main trick I'm going to tell you about today is whatever you do in your architecture, try to break everything up into these logarithmic trees, and that enables you to get low latency and get things to work quickly. And so there's one more step, is that even on the classical side, you also have to use the same trick. So how are you going to keep track? Are you going to have to send step by step, like in a CCD, in a charge coupled device, like in your digital cameras, step by step, send the electrons down the chain? Again, you would end up being very slow because it would be proportional to the number of digits in the binary number. But instead, what you do is, again, you do pairwise logarithmic tree just for the classical addition. So first you add them pairwise, then you add groups of four, then you add groups of eight, and then you add all 16 together. And so even on the classical side of just accumulating all this information, all the Bell state measurements that you need for entanglement swapping, even that has to be done as a logarithmic tree. So let me sort of summarize then, is that it looks like even with nearest neighbor interactions, there is a way to do things, that a very efficient parallel architecture like Cleave and Watros can actually be implemented even with nearest neighbor interactions. The depth, in other words, the latency or the amount of time it takes to do the whole factorization can be reasonable. Of course, all these numbers have to be multiplied by the concatenation. So that's why you've got to worry about the speed and the depth and so forth. And so the key trick, just like Cleveland-Watros showed, is that if you're clever, you can do everything in log L steps. And all the communication, even though it's nearest neighbor communication, that can also be done in log L steps. So it's going to be log L, maybe not squared, maybe a higher exponent, but still of the order of log L in the time it takes to do the factorization. And some of these other options maybe are less favorable options in terms of trying to get the factorization to work in reasonable time. So let me summarize. It seems that if you can visualize a system where you can get a half a degree of phase accuracy, you're getting into the right ballpark for achieving fault tolerance. And I think there are a lot of systems like this. I don't want to say that the semiconductor spins are the only such system. The quantum gates, it looks like they can be laid out in 2D arrays, and there could be enough space for all the classical control electronics. That there's a role for nearest neighbor exchange swap, and the nearest neighbor exchange swap is really if you're going a very short distance. So if you're going a very short distance, just do swap operations with the nearest neighbors. But if you have to go a longer distance, entanglement swapping seems to be the best way to go, and that the entanglement swapping can be done in a kind of a logarithmic tree, and that this would be suitable for long-distance communication. And maybe a little optimistic, but I would say that we're not that far off from being able to build a factorization engine, provided someone will pay for it. Thank you very much.